You're listening to the Drawing the Ideal Self podcast for January 2024. In today's episode, we're going to look at an idea called The Community of Self by Miller Mair. I've taken this from a book called Towards a Radical Redefinition of Psychology, the selected works of Miller Mair, edited by David Winter and Nick Reed. To set it in some context, I'm going to tell you what they have to say about him. So they begin with, John Mitchell Miller Mair was born on 14th of May 1937 in Aberdeenshire in Scotland, the younger of two boys. He describes himself as a country boy, brought up in a family much influenced by the Church of Scotland, in which he considered that there were expectations that he would follow a family tradition of joining the ministry. However, as a teenager, he came to realise he did not believe in the religious dogmas concerned, and eventually completed an MA in psychology at the University of Aberdeen, in the process of being awarded the Henry Prize in psychology, before training in clinical psychology at the Institute of Psychiatry in London and completing a PhD at the University of London. He soon found, though, that he was unable to believe in the dominant psychological dogma of the time, namely learning theory, and in the behavioural methods derived from it that were championed at the Institute of Psychiatry. Like several similarly disenchanted psychologists of his generation, he then had the liberating experience of discovering personal construct theory, devised by the American psychologist George Kelly, 1955, another country boy from a Presbyterian background. He described his excitement, a mixture of illumination, delight, and a sense of expansive beauty at reading the two weighty volumes in which Kelly set out his vision of a new psychology, and considered that he was involved in a dance with Kelly ever since. They go on to say that Miller's co-conspirators in his initial exploration of personal construct psychology and promotion of its ideas were a group of psychologists that came to be known as the Kelly Club, the most prominent members of which were Don Bannister, Faye Franceller, and Phyllida Salmon. They were all highly influential in the life of personal construct psychology in the UK. One of Mair's major contributions was the metaphor of the community of self, and I'm going to tell you what he had to say about that. It's a really useful idea and can be used in therapeutic encounters. So you can invite people to make a representation of their community of self. Either that could be in writing, or it could be in art form, or it could even be in acting out a play with different characters. This kind of idea has been carried on. If you're familiar with the CBT technique, the homunculi approach, that's a technique designed to work with children and young people, but it's based on the idea that there are characters within us that might influence how we behave. And sometimes when one character is in charge, so to speak, you can get a different response than if another is in charge. I mean, the homunculi is a really nice kind of way of working with children and young people. It does refer to working out your thoughts and feelings, which is obviously a CBT approach to divide that up. But you can use it within a PCP approach. So I'm going to read some to you directly from Mair, which is his chapter of the community of self in this book. And what he says is this: instead of viewing any particular person as an individual unit, I would like you to entertain, for the time being, the mistaken view of any person as if he or she were a community of selves. This is clearly an invitation to make believe, though I hope it will become apparent that we seem to construct our realities through just this kind of willing self-deception. It is not, though, a specially novel idea, since this kind of notion has repeatedly been used through the centuries, and, as I'll indicate later, is still widely used in many forms. My belief, however, is that by exploring the notion of self as community, explicitly as an exercise in metaphor, we may be able to grasp some of its possibilities for understanding and action. perhaps it is easiest to introduce the idea of self as if a community of selves by referring to the smallest form of community, namely a community of two persons. Most of us have probably at some time found ourselves talking or acting as if we were two people rather than one. We talk sometimes of being in two minds about something, part of you wanting to do one thing and part wanting to do something else. Quite often we hear of people talking about having to battle with themselves, as if one aspect of themselves was in conflict with another. Often we pass this sort of thing over as only a form of expression. However, the explicit invitation to consider oneself for the moment as two people rather than oneself can make it possible for us to pay attention first to one of the people and then to the other one. In this activity, the person can be encouraged to ignore, for the moment, one of the selves and get inside the other. From this vantage point of being inside one side or party in the dispute, rather than being only vaguely aware of the two sides as an outsider from some separate vantage point, it is sometimes possible for the person to sense more fully some of the hopes and fears, values and plans, concerns and confusions of this other person. Thereafter, a similar activity of entering and experiencing from the other party to the dispute can be undertaken. Not infrequently, a graphically clear impression is obtained of the incompatibilities and suspicions, assumptions and tactics of the two selves in relation to each other, and between them and members of other communities. The notion of oneself as a community of selves can readily be elaborated further by some people to incorporate three, four, or any other number of selves. Some of these selves will be found to persist, and others may be more transitory. Some will be isolates, and others will work in teams. Some will appear in many circumstances, and others only on a few special kinds of occasions. Some will be more powerful, and others will give way to them. Sometimes, people can offer and use quite elaborated accounts in their community of selves. Since these show up some of the features of this metaphor in action, a few examples may be helpful. Mayer goes on to give three examples, and I'm going to include two of them here, particularly because they came with a similar problem. David. David found the metaphor useful as he worked over a long period of time to resolve his problems which centred around his stammer. He came from Northern Ireland and had stammered since childhood. Like John, that's the person in the first example he's given, he also chose a political interpretation of the metaphor of community. Within these terms, David talks as if he were composed of a number of political factions. Initially, he outlined three groups. The hardliners were aggressive, right-wing, impatient, bigoted, unforgiving and cynical. The softliners were concerned in all circumstances and on all occasions with finding and taking the easy way out, with appeasement, maintaining the status quo, and with letting sleeping dogs lie. Between these was the middle group, who were less clear-cut, but were more or less reasonable, without very definite opinions, liable to be swayed in one direction or another, and fairly down to earth. These groups, and especially the hard and soft liners, were engaged with each other and the world in the continuing confusions of warfare and resistance, appeasement and withdrawal. The speaker in David's parliament had the unenviable job of trying to present to the world the common view of the whole community. But in most circumstances, any single viewpoint was simply non-existent. Instead of this, strident claims and counterclaims were the order of things. Indeed, as David explored his community further, he became aware of even more extreme hard and extreme softline groups. Between these extremes, there were huge and persistent differences in policy and values. The hardliners didn't seem to know the meaning of ideas like withdrawal or surrender, and would fight anywhere and on the slightest provocation. The softliners, on the other hand, had an equally intense policy of appeasement, of peace at any price. If presented with the choice of speaking or not, the hardliners would absolutely insist on being heard, while the softliners would prefer not to speak at all. David felt that the softliners sometimes retreated into total silence to keep out of trouble, but were then dragged out by the even greater anger of the hardliners to assert some kind of position. On being asked if these two sides ever spoke to each other, David instantly replied that neither of these extremist wings had ever wanted to admit that the other side was there at all. The hardliners took the attitude that they should never acknowledge that there was a stammer, while the softline side was ready and eager to admit to stammering in everything and anything if necessary. David indicated that the side which had been strongest for most of his life was the one which claimed he didn't stammer at all. But he pointed out that a friend of his who also stammered had chosen the opposite position and become a virtual recluse. As David made further use of the metaphor of community, he became aware that the middle group was more like a loose collection of various individuals and groups. He began to talk about occasional experiences of feeling and acting in a more relaxed manner. By personifying this experience, he began to work out some of the implications and possible involvements of this more relaxed and uncommitted group, which occupied some of the middle ground in his political spectrum. This group did not seem to be aligned with any other factions, and because of this, David thought they might well frighten a number of other people in his community who were alarmed by anyone who did not take definite stands in relation to conventional issues. About this time, David noticed that occasionally he was speaking without any forethought and in a relaxed manner. He found, though, that when he did this, he stammered a lot. He felt that as soon as this more relaxed and spontaneous involvement in speech occurred, there was a reactive feeling of shock and anxiety within the different factions in his community, with the various committed groups taking over firm control again. David indicated that he wanted this relaxed group to wander all through his community and spread their kind of feeling and concerns. In pursuing this, David felt that his relaxed group might belong to a further grouping, which he referred to as a friendly group. They seemed as though they might be people who would be friendly with anyone, who cared about others, and were charitable in their actions and thoughts. David felt that this gradually emerging friendly group might well be more prepared than anyone else to tolerate the views of others in the community, even though they might personally disagree with them. It was through this clustering of relaxed, friendly, and free and easy groups that he began to develop a more active involvement with people at work and home. The battle for control within his community, however, was fought long and hard. The hard and softliners only very gradually released control as other more flexible and warm groupings spread their influence and tested their competence in coping with the everyday affairs of living. The next example is Peter, and Mare included it because he said that this example may be useful to indicate that other interpretations of community than a political one can be used, and also to indicate that people with the same problem, in this instance stammering, are not necessarily very similar to each other. Rather than talk in terms of parliament or political factions, Peter developed his interpretation of the community theme in terms of a troop of players. His troop seemed to him to be guided by a council, whose general task was to keep performance and performances in balance. The main controller of the day-to-day activities was the producer. His job was to take responsibility for what was happening on stage at any moment in time, This producer seemed to like being fairly easygoing and often tried to be on equal terms with the various players. This could be pleasant when no great demands were being made on the troupe, but even then, in the lax atmosphere, there was a recurrent tendency for arrangements to become unstuck. Jobs did not seem to get done, and gradually the players would find themselves in dire trouble, without sufficient cohesion or organisation to pull things together. At times like this, the producer would be forced out of his laissez-faire approach and become an autocratic martinet. He would clamp down and impose a kind of martial law or a state of emergency. Sharp orders would then be given and would have to be obeyed, and many of the actors who couldn't or wouldn't respond to this kind of treatment were banned or suspended till the emergency was over. Among the actors, Peter initially outlined the following. There was the conversationalist, who loved company for company's sake, enjoyed the give and take of ideas, and was never happier than when relaxing in good company. Balancing and offsetting him was the businessman, who was very practical and down to earth. He always had to be getting somewhere and had to be engaged in organised, constructive action, or he became very frustrated. For long periods of time, these two could occupy complementary parts, each taking spells of being advanced on stage. However, there seemed always to be a tendency for one or the other to hog the limelight when he got into it. This repeatedly led to trouble, and performances would get completely out of balance in one direction or the other. Then there was the country bumpkin, who had no mind for detail or finesse, but saw the main points in anything and would just batter on with things in crude but purposeful ways around these main issues. He was balanced by the metropolitan smooth man, who in contrast was very much concerned with detail. He considered that refusal to master detail was just a sign of laziness and stupidity. There was the adventurer, who used to love going on long cycle runs, enjoyed climbing mountains, and relished any challenge like facing a new job or a new situation, in which the slate was wiped clear and he was free to act in accordance with circumstances. He had been a prominent character for some time in the past, but was less apparent in the present. Along with him came the sentimental lover, who was all emotion, sentiment, and tenderness. He expressed himself a lot in the context of Peter's marriage. It seemed he could come on stage there, but otherwise he was kept in the background. He was very fond of animals and children, and was generally very loving and warm. Another very important actor in the troupe was the dreamer. He hated being tied down to anything, but was quite a pleasant character. He always wanted to take part in things which were relaxing and pleasing. He loved the countryside and nature generally. If he ever found himself being tied down or having to be highly organised, he just withdrew. Thus, when the producer was in an autocratic phase, the dreamer was always one of the first to disappear. However, it was apparently the dreamer who was especially fertile in the production of ideas, and quite a number of the things which the other characters made capital from came from him in the first place. Peter commented on how real these characters seemed to him. But as we continued it, it became apparent that very little communication existed between the different players. The producer seemed to be the only person with continuing responsibility for getting the show on the road. The other players seemed to be very much character part actors, whose only concern was with their particular act. There seemed to be little sense of shared responsibility or interlacing of interests among the various actors. When the producer let things slide into a free and easy democracy, everyone seemed to just slouch around and let things slide further. This in turn would lead to yet another dictatorial purge by the producer, who would precipitately grab back all the authority he had recently relinquished in order to get some sort of adequate show underway. Peter found that his stammering became particularly bad during the phase of laissez-faire disintegration, when the producer relinquished firm control and all players lost any sense of direction and order. As part of a programme of community development, Peter undertook a number of tasks to try and increase the understanding and communication between important members of his troop. The intention here was to try to foster more sharing of responsibility among the different members, so that less crisis control action would be necessary by the producer. In the course of this, Peter tried to get inside each of the main characters in turn to experience from the inside something of their personal concerns. On the basis of this, we then tried to develop more exchange between the players and more participation in each other's actions. The long-term concern here was to find and extend common areas of interest and ways of working together so that they need not continue in virtual isolation, relying on the peremptory commands of an often harassed producer. Mayor goes on to give some comments on community. Hopefully, these examples will convey something of the ways in which the metaphor as self as community can be interpreted in use. The metaphor is, of course, not a solution in itself for most problems of living, nor does it make sense or seem usable by everyone. Even those who do make something out of it for their personal uses find that they can sometimes make more use of it than at other times and seem to be more ready for it in some circumstances than others. However, my intention here is neither to expound its practical application nor to provide a full critique of its limitations. I only want to indicate some of the more obvious features of this image of man. The community metaphor seems to provide, for most people at least, a flexible framework within which to represent and express many aspects of their experience in relation to themselves and to others. It seems to provide a means by which they can open out and can sense something of the pattern of their engagements, which were previously cramped in and hard to grasp. One of the advantages of this framework is that it offers to everyone something already familiar in many different forms. Everyone has experience of living in some sort of communities, whether they be family, neighbourhood groups, recreational clubs or teams, work situations in shops or factories or offices, larger scale communities like nations with governments and models of administration, or even constellations of nations in the world at large. There is endless variety and complexity here, and also simplicity. Since useful elaboration can be done within a community composed of two people, no esoteric language need be involved, although any amount of it is available should it be desired. For some people, there is also something very obvious about the metaphor when used in relation to their own experience, while at the same time its use often provides surprisingly fresh perspectives. Clearly, the metaphor lays emphasis not on isolation, but on interrelationships. Within this view, methods and kinds of communication and ways in which communication is restricted or prevented are clearly important. Possibilities for increased communication can here be made available between ourselves and between members in different communities. In all this, one potentially fertile feature of the metaphor is that it invites us to explore a personal experience in the world in the same sorts of terms which we normally reserve for social events. Of course, any metaphor can be pressed too far and result in meaningless confusion. But it may be that some useful developments could arise from understanding personal functioning in terms normally restricted to social psychology and sociology, and conversely, from exploring aspects of social structure, group pressures and prejudices, organisational control and change, and such like, within the laboratory of personal communities of selves. We can see, indeed, that using this metaphor, a psychological understanding of any person would make use of concepts and methods drawn from many other disciplines. In giving some account of personal communities, we may find useful concepts already available in the fields of politics, group processes, diplomacy, debate, propaganda, industrial organisation, labour relations, international trade, law, theatre, literature, arts and sciences. Anything which we find useful in conceiving or guiding action in the various communities within which we live, including the ecological community, wherein man lives in relation to other aspects of his environment, may be potentially relevant by metaphoric transference in giving some account of our community of selves. So I'm wondering what you might be able to do with that. If this is your first introduction to Community of Selves, there are other things you can read, and it's in the PCP pocketbook, but this may be enough, because what you might want to try and do is think about the community of selves you have for yourself. That way you can explore it quite safely, and you can see what you make of the idea of it, and remember that it is a metaphor, it's not a real thing. It's a way of thinking about ourselves and the conflicts that we have within us. It particularly lends itself to an exploration of roles and how those roles might conflict with each other. And so if you think of something like being a parent, at the same time being a friend, there are going to be moments where you have to decide you're going to be maybe less of a brilliant parent because your friend needs some support. Or you're not going to see much of your friends because you need to sort out things with your child or take them to their activities or whatever. So during those times, how do those things get sorted out? How do you decide who takes control? And remember, this is a metaphor. It's an idea of a way of thinking about it rather than saying we have these characters within ourselves that do take control. So you can think of it quite playfully. One of the things that I quite like about the homunculi approach is exactly that. It can be very playful. And it was actually based on a comic, which is probably one of the most playful things you can imagine. The story of the numbskulls, who were little characters who lived inside people's heads. And the idea in the homunculi approach is you get a team of people who try to work together to address problems as they come up. This is more than that, because this is about a way of functioning throughout life. And there are going to be moments where one of your selves might actually be causing you a bit of a problem because it's getting a bit too big and pushing the others out. And you want to give a bit more sort of airtime to some of the others. So what you could do is write maybe a description of those different characters that you can imagine yourself as having, and perhaps give them a situation and look at how that might play out. I'm thinking of it as a bit like a sort of storyboard or a script for a play. That might work to do it. The other way you can do it is to draw them. So you can do a kind of a circle and chop it into pizza slices. And each of those slices is a different character. So you could draw what they're like and write descriptions of them. And just have a look, kind of who you've got, what are the roles that you play, and how do things get worked out? If you want to use it with other people, the key is to invite them for their description of their community to be whatever suits them. So, you know, if they're mad on football, it could be a football team. It could be an orchestra. It could be a troupe of players. You could try with that one if you fancy it. But it could be tailored for the person that you're working with so that they have some constructs around that which they've already developed. My suggestion would definitely be try it with yourself first and see what you make of it before you try it with anybody else. Okay, so I hope that gives you something to go and experiment with. And remember that you can find the references. I'll put them in the show notes so that you can get to those books quite quickly. PCP books from the Coventry Constructivist Centre are very cheap. And I will see you again next month. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.